Hello. So I'm going to take this back a little bit after we've been talking about the supernova and basically talk about what the models of the stars look like before they explode. So we saw this plot up yesterday showing basically the compactness for a variety of initial masses for the stars. What I want to basically talk about today is what's driving the kind of variations we see in this value of the compactness, and can we start to put error bars on these points, and what does this start to look like in the models? And we've heard quite a bit yesterday about how the progenitors affect the resulting supernova, so hopefully I can start to say what the different progenitors look like. So, heard this phrase on Monday from Frank about an ensemble of models. So what we've been looking at is basically a whole set of different masses using MESA, evolving from the pre-main sequence up to core collapse, looking at basically different spatial resolutions, different nuclear networks, which is effectively saying which isotopes and nuclear reactions do we think are important in the models. Also looking basically with and without mass loss. We've heard quite a bit about that today during the whole week. So what I'm going to do, all the models for this, for anyone who wants to try and blow these up, are available online. So what I'm going to do today is basically go through the star's evolution and talk about basically how variations in the final state appear as you go through for the different major fuel stages. So we start simply on the main sequence, hydrogen burning, should be straightforward, but what we see is two 30 solar masses. You've got a kind of a low resolution model and a medium resolution. So as the star evolves from left to right, you start to see convection in blue. You've got the yellow and orange showing the nuclear burning. And you see this kind of fingers of semi-convection and convection forming. As you crank up the resolution, these fingers basically move inwards, and eventually they move in so much that you basically hit the hydrogen core, which can inject fresh fuel. And this, you know, this event adds 10% uncertainty to your final ages, your core masses. This is really kind of starting out with quite a big uncertainty in what these models are doing. It's also quite non-linear, so if these fingers move inwards, if they get very close, it doesn't really do anything. It's really got to get all the way into the hydrogen core.
So is the right plot converged?
So this is at a higher resolution, but it's also, this is also basically a function of saying how strong is semi-convection. So if you made this model with a higher semi-convection, you could have this effect. It's, if I show you the next. So this is basically showing the kind of helium core mass at the end of the main sequence. And basically these models in blue are the ones which don't do this effect. And then as you see in the, basically the yellow are the ones that do, which have this extra injection. So it's looking converged. But again, this is a degeneracy with the strength of semi-convection, which is a free parameter in our models.
Are you using constant mass zones?
So this is setting the minimum resolution, but the zones can vary by however MESA wants to vary the mass.
But this is the smallest zone?
Yes, this is the smallest zone, in a sense.
It's very big.
You mean the largest?
Largest, sorry. Yeah.
The largest. Yeah. The minimum resolution.
Yeah. So if we move kind of forward onto helium burning, we can basically show what kind of the evolution of the helium at the center of the star is doing for different nuclear networks. And you see these spikes appear for these 22 isotope network, which is other people call it the alpha chain network, where you're just following helium additions. And what's happening is basically this is uncertainties we have in the models of how the convective boundary behaves at the kind of when you get to very once the helium starts to be depleted. And what's important for us to consider is basically these add extra burn-in events basically into the star, so you end up with basically more oxygen in your core relative to carbon, which is going to start to then change how carbon burning happens in your star. And I know some people I think are already talking about this during this program, but you know, we probably need a better model of what the boundary of these cores are doing. So if we go forward again to the next step of carbon burning, start to see, so these are 20 solar mass models. So at this point in the purple regions are basically showing you your neutrino dominated. And what you can start to see is basically, depending on your resolution, you can basically have different types of carbon burning. This is important because you can see basically how much carbon can you burn during carbon burning is going to be affected by whether you can have convection zones over the whole model or not. The other interesting thing is basically this is what you would expect in a slightly lower mass star and what you kind of expect in a slightly higher mass star. So now you're basically showing the resolution is equivalent to changing the initial mass of these objects. So you're starting to see again another a degeneracy between these terms. And the important thing, of course, is this is setting the stage for what the final model is going to look like, because depending how much carbon you have left depends how the carbon shells later on will ignite.
Is there overshooting of these shells?
Yes, there is a little bit of overshooting. Yes. I kept overshooting fixed for all these models, but again, that's another free parameter in the models. Yes. Move on to neon burning. Not so many papers seem to be on neon burning, but so this is again with different nuclear networks and basically showing what the center density temperature is doing. You can see different tracks, and basically basically as the networks increase in size, you get slightly denser cores, which is increasing your thermal neutrino losses. This basically then delays the neon ignition, and when it does ignite, it becomes more vigorous. And basically for this 30 solar mass model, we can basically do whatever we want with neon. We can ignite it radiatively, we can invite it convectively, center, off center. It's really a kind of a big mess as to what this thing is actually going to do. So next fuel to burn is oxygen. So this is now 215 solar mass models at a low resolution and a high resolution. You see basically oxygen burns in a very thin shell at the bottom with quite a large convective shell on top. And you see these kind of big inflows of the material moving inwards and outwards. And this basically is effectively inefficient, or the oxygen is basically inefficiently burned here, which is how you end up with this shell basically igniting at this point rather than up here. In these models, basically you've burned a lot more of the oxygen, so you can't ignite an oxygen shell here because there's no oxygen left, so you have to ignite it higher. So what you can start to see, of course, is that again this kind of non-linear behavior happening in these models, because you can start to have all these extra flashes and ignitions and fuel sources that are burning. And this, every time you ignite a shell, it's basically you take an entirely different evolution at that point through for the star. So everything starts to basically diverge. At this point, we're basically starting to become quite sensitive to what the isotopes and the nuclear reactions we think are important in these stars. And there's been quite a lot of work, of course, recently in 3D modeling, and hopefully some of these 3D models can start to tell us what's happening so we can feed it back into the 1D models. So as the isotopes and the reactions are starting to become important, we can also talk about about the reaction rates. So Frank showed this on Monday again, but this is the basically if you vary the carbon oxygen rate within known measurement uncertainties. So basically zero on this plot is the standard rate and you increase it going to the right. You can start to see how the compactness of this core starts to change. And you get basically 20% uncertainty in this compactness just from the known measurement errors in the nuclear rates.
Is there a log of a rate factor on the
bottom? Yes.
So you're varying it by 10,000?
But then it gets normalized against the original.
I don't understand what you mean by renormal. Is it 100 times slower or 100 times faster or not?
I'm not sure. This work's still in prep. There's been some other work recently as well with the Kepler code looking at kind of a similar thing and looking at basically S processing, and you start to see kind of up to factors of two in the abundances. So the rates are, we're limited here by what the measurements can do, and it's just starting to show possibly quite large variations in what the cores are doing.
Something,
if it was 100 times smaller, it would be like it was zero. Yeah.
So I'm not understanding something.
So this was work by Sukbold et al. Showing basically get for Kepler models for basically a very low metallicity and a solar metallicity, showing basically how the compactness varies as a function of mass. You can see quite a large variation depending on your metallicity of what you choose. And you, although this is metallicity, they pin this actually on mass loss as the differences in how much star mass the star loses. And again, we've heard quite a lot this week about how the things like the winds and episodic mass loss, possibly binarity if you're adding or removing mass. And this isn't even getting into the complexity of if you have a stellar merger or not, as to how this thing starts to affect the final state of the star. So if we try and quantify a little bit more what's going on, so this is a paper by Matthew Renz, which hopefully should be coming out this week or so. This is a series of Mason models again, and this time you've got different mass loss prescriptions for the same initial mass, as well as different strengths of the mass loss. So this is really probing how mass loss affects the models, affects things like the lifetimes, the core masses, etc. You can see basically the tracks are the same up until around here when you start to burn neon and oxygen, etc., where you then start to see this kind of large spread again, which is another 20% uncertainty in these values just from different choices in how you lose the mass from the star. So if we go forward again then from oxygen onto silicon burning. So this is 225 solar mass models. This is the kind of 22 isotopes and 200 isotopes. And on the left, we see basically what these are both measured at the same time for these different models. You can see basically quite different abundant structures. You've got a kind of a standard iron core, silicon shell and oxygen shell in this model. But in this model, you've got the iron core again. You've got a very thin silicon shell and a very large oxygen shell. And what happened was this basically it ignited oxygen in a shell. This was vigorous and large enough that it actually hit into a carbon shell that was also burning at that point, which then moved a lot of oxygen in, but also then stopped it from burning too much oxygen into silicon. I'm not saying all models do this, but this is where you're starting to see is bifurcation and different models doing quite radical different things depending on what the initial states of these things were before you started igniting the shells. And start to see things like factors of two changes in lifetimes of the silicon burning, just going to change how big you can make the cores of these stars. Interesting question, of course, for anyone who wants to try and blow these up is how is this going to affect the explosion, and what you can then see based on the fact you've got a lot more oxygen, so got a lot more calcium in these models. So can we say anything? You know, there's lots of models, lots of variations in the models. How can we try and kind of constrain what these stars are doing? So this work with Kelly Patton, looking at the neutrino signal. So this is for a 20 and a 30 solar mass model, basically showing the neutrino spectrum. So the area in white, basically above 2, is what's the interesting area for the detectors. And you see, basically, we get a very strong signal from the weak decays. And we're still working on exactly how detectable these are and things like the background noise at this point. But these things should be detectable within a few kiloparsecs. There are, it's the log-log, so it's hard to see, but there are factors of 2 in neutrino counts and slight differences in the spectrum. So maybe we can start to resolve what's going on in these stars before core collapse, and hopefully perhaps trying to constrain some of these uncertainties in the physics. And of course, there's been some other work as well recently from a couple of Japanese groups on this as well. So getting back to what I was saying at the start about trying to put error bars on the data points. So this is the compactness again against initial mass. In black, we have the Kepler results from Suckwold. And then in the red, we basically got the results from this paper for non-mass losing stars. And then in blue is showing what happens as you turn on mass loss. I haven't integrated in the results of Matthew's work or from the rates, but you can see that basically there is quite a wide range of possible parameters for what these final stars could look like. You know, things under this yellow region are probably easy to explode, while things at the top are probably hard to explode, and things like the 20 and the 25 could be basically anywhere you want in this parameter space. So I'm just going to finish with what my summary. Basically, the final state of these models is quite uncertain. It's quite non-linear. It's based on complex history of how different fuels burn, how they ignite. The uncertainties you've really got to worry about all the way from the start of your models all the way to the end. Be interesting to talk to people about how these things are going to affect the supernova. There's also a whole range of extra free parameters that I've not even talked about here, like rotation, convection, overshoot, things like the episodic mass loss, how this is going to affect the models, and whether some of these things are going to start having correlations between the different properties. Thank you.
Overview of pre-supernova phases. Questions? Stan?
It's the same sort of thing as with Frank. There's a lot of noise in stellar evolution, and my opinion these days is that it's really a statistical study. Yeah. I mean, you can run a 14.9 and a 15 solar mass star, and they look totally different.
Yeah.
Part of it is what you have here in your summary, that it's a nonlinear propagation from the beginning to the end. You make a little change upstream, it makes a big change downstream. So, of course, if you've changed your carbon-oxygen core size, silicon burning is going to look very different by the time you get there. All of which is to say you need maybe to do a little more study of the statistics of the outcome. The general statement, which may be wrong, but the general statement is that if you do a grid of masses, you average over a lot of these effects and a lot of the noise goes away. That you can't really say what a 15 solar mass star is specifically going to look like. Different groups are always going to get different answers, and that's one reason people running core collapse should run some standard set of models and not compare a 15 from here to a 15 from there.
I agree that there is no 15 solar mass model in a sense. You know, there's a whole variety. There's lots of different choices for how the three parameters for convection, there's lots of choices for how you solve the physics. So this is just trying to make people aware that there is you know, there are possible, there are error bars on these things, and that there isn't just one model for each of these masses. You've got to, I mean, maybe, if we, you know, maybe people saying 25 solar masses are, you know, these failed supernova, or maybe they've just got the wrong initial, they've got a different, if you had a different 25 solar mass model, it wouldn't be a failed supernova. So I agree with your statement.
I mean, I guess I draw slightly the opposite conclusion from Stan, which is that everyone trying to explode the same models, Woosley-Hager 2007 or whatever, could be very misleading, because that may, just because of this, all these effects, that may not actually,
if they only do one,
if they do the 25, the 24, and the 26, maybe. So then a question about this plot. So if I ask your, I mean, I would kind of naively say the closest to relevant answer is the highest resolution with the largest net, et cetera. So where are those in your error bars? Are those at the bottom or at the top? Or somewhere in the middle?
So these are the median ones.
I mean, net and resolution aren't, it's not obvious those are things you want to average over. You might say bigger net is closer to reality.
True, so, but then what we've been shown earlier, that some of these effects that, you know, these are model effects, the resolution and network, but they're also showing up effects that the other physics would kind of show, so like the semi-convection at the start and the resolution. So you average over, and you can start to average over these other effects that are happening.
I have probably a difficult question, and maybe even to the modelers, to the evolution modelers, quite a somewhat unfair question. I mean, considering the sensitivity resolution, and actually some of the issues, if I read Subbald Woosley correctly, are even connected to the many ifs which are in codes distinguishing in one direction or the other. I mean, what does that mean in the with respect to basic physics? Does it mean that 1D with if statements in the code is unable to capture certain physics which will not be in the simulations or not be in the modeling in if we did it in full 3D, if we were able to do it in full 3D? Or what does it mean? Or will we always be facing this kind of underdeterministic behavior which models naturally will have if there's if statements which are depending on real numbers?
I mean, yeah, so I mean, there is physics that the 1D is not capturing. There's things like convection that, you know, with kind of waiting for the 3D modelers to help us with the convection and mix and length theory. There's also, I mean, there's a lot of free parameters that are just going to be things that we need to calibrate over time. But things like the nuclear reaction rates, where we have the known uncertainties, you just got to be able to take into account that maybe your rate isn't exactly what you think it is, and this is going to affect how your final star looks. Time and more models. Hopefully, if we can start to get some signals, maybe of what these stars look like before explosion, to try and compare them to observables, and try and just to narrow the parameter space a little.
And another final question in this context. I don't want to take the time from the other. How much of this? I mean, Alex has made an even more extreme effort than Stan and Tuck. Alex has put out models with a spacing of 0.01 solar masses, and you could still see the kind of discontinuous behavior from 0. Within hundredths of a solar mass steps. So what should I conclude from that?
I think you just got to be realistic that there are going to be differences in the different models, and that, I mean, maybe perhaps not in the 3D, but in the 2D and the 1D, we start to try and explode these things and look, see how much does the difference between this, you know, a 0.01 difference in these models make to the explosion, and try and just try and put some error bars on the data points.
This is wonderful that you went first. I get to respond to you. I may be sitting in the chair, your infamous chair from Monday when you declared something to be meaningless. And I'm very tempted to do the same thing now. back to what Elliot's comments were, it's you know that it matters how much resolution you use for your 3D models. If you did a really, really low resolution model, you wouldn't expect it to give the same results as a high resolution model. So you try to do experiments to see, am I converged yet? Can I really believe at this level of resolution I'm getting some reasonable results? That question applies for these 1D models. Are they converged yet? I think that all that we learned from this today, I think, is not much about uncertainties, but about the complete lack of convergence. Not at all converged. And so getting a grid, a more finely spaced model in mass of completely unconverged models is probably meaningless. Okay? So the question is, how close are we getting to things that might be converged, that might produce meaningful models? Is that going to be forever out of reach for us? We are never going to capture the full range of physics that you're capturing, obviously. Maybe we can make models that capture the essence of some aspects of that physics in 1D, but like we do with convection, and maybe we can do something like that with Rayleigh-Taylor, and maybe we can't. There is no guarantee at all that 1D is going to be able to capture all of the relevant physics that you're able to explore in 3D models. So what we really need is you to bring your 6 month time down to 6 minutes so that we can forget all this nonsense with 1D. But that's not going to happen in any time soon, as you well know. So that good. My real role on this, remember, I came out from a very different area. When I was a graduate student, our saying was, if it involves floating point numbers, it's evil, don't do that. Okay? So I never touched a floating point number. It was just ridiculous. You could not do anything interesting with floating point numbers. So I've somehow have slipped away from that in my ancient period here. But, yeah, it's hard, and the computations are intensely complicated, and they're not converged typically yet. The 1D ones certainly are not, and I think that's what we're starting to see. So that's progress, and at least we're seeing that we're not converged. It's not a very happy progress. But now Stan can tell you what it's really going.
So I just want to follow up on just with a very, very brief remark, just that maybe in addition to trying to reproduce the physical fidelity of the three-dimensional behavior, we should be investigating the mathematical convergence properties of the 1D models that we apply as well. No, it's not quite, because whether they actually do converge or not.
Okay, I just want to come back to Esan's talk and remind you that we don't have full freedom on core overshoot and chemical mixing anymore if you go to gravity modes in near core regions of stars. Now, I'm not computing supernova at all, but we do pin down these parameters to ranges that are finite, and you're just taking one value. And your predictions of these parameters just depend much more on what you take there. But there is information in the literature, recent literature, on the limitations thanks to gravity modes. So please take that into account.
Yeah, I mean, there are many free parameters. You basically have to start somewhere, is the case.
Yeah. Of course the models have to be converged. Yeah. Tom and I knew that in 1978. So we ran it with one resolution and twice the resolution and four times the resolution. We did that in the late 70s. Our models are, you know, I can't say you run the same model twice, you won't get a slightly different answer, but it certainly won't be anything like that. The other thing, because, you know, some of your models that you're comparing there were more converged than others, you know. Yes, you'd like to use the higher resolution models, I think, on that plot. But the other thing to note is you've drawn your lines exactly where the dispersion in the black points is biggest. That is, there are places in the compactness parameter plot that are chaotic, and there are others where you can see where the line is very smooth. where you change it half a solar mass, you can interpolate from the other masses. But in particular, around 20 solar masses, where you're changing from convective carbon core burning to radiative carbon core burning, things are very, very sensitive to small changes. You could change the time step as well as the resolution. You could change any reaction rate and go down a different path. So it's a little unfair to be doing your studies right where the curve has the biggest variation.
Yeah, well, I mean, we took this, I mean, these are nice round numbers.
Yeah, let's 50, 15, 25, worst possible.
Okay, I think it's 12:30, so unless there is a flash question, or are we finished? Okay, so we wrap it up here. We thank Rob and all speakers today.